Asia-Pacific currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia-Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia-Asia Worker Links.
Hello and welcome to Asia Pacific Currents this morning. I'm Kieran Bennett. Thanks to Solidarity Breakfast for another stellar show. This morning, we've got a fantastic interview for you coming up with Bella Bahraini, if I pronounce that properly, which I probably haven't, speaking about the situation in Iran. But before we get to that, we'll go to news from around the region. Asia Pacific Currents, of course, is brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. And you can find out more about Australia Asia Worker Links on the web, www.aawl.org.au. We're also on Facebook and Substack. Over to the news first. We're heading over to India, where an estimated 300 million Indian workers and farmers participated in a nationwide strike on Thursday to protest the labour codes introduced by the Modi government in November. The All India Trade Union Congress called the strike in solidarity with central trade unions and farmers' unions, and opposition MPs joined and supported the protest. In addition to the labour codes, the strike also protested the privatisation of the public sector, the contractualisation of work, the dilution of job security, wages and social protection for millions of workers across the country. The protest called for statutory minimum wages, universal social security and protection of the public sector. For farmers, the union reiterated a demand for a guarantee of minimum support, price and safeguards of livelihoods. Some striking workers also call for the scrapping of a recent trade deal with the United States. The unions called on the government to engage in meaningful dialogue with trade unions and farmers' organisations. Heading now to Fiji, where Fiji construction unions have declared a strike. The Construction, Energy and Timber Workers Union of Fiji, CETWF, announced on Tuesday that Energy Fiji Limited workers will take strike action from Sunday, February 15, due to an ongoing industrial dispute with the power utility. The dispute followed a voluntary mediation process that formed part of collective bargaining talks organised and facilitated by the Ministry of Employment. The CETWF withdrew from mediation on Saturday, saying the company was acting in bad faith after the company implemented salary increases and benefits for workers represented by the Fiji Electricity Workers Association, but not for CETWF members who make up the majority of the workforce. Shame. The National Secretary of CETWF said it was deliberate discrimination against workers for being members of his union. The CETWF said it would wait for the matter to be addressed through arbitration court proceedings next month.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM, the voice of the community.
3CR, community radio, giving the voice to the community since 1976.
Heading now to Turkey, where sacked Turkish workers are heading to company HQ in Germany. This week marked 390 days since sacked workers at Digel Textiles in Turkey have been picketing the company. Digel workers have faced systematic anti-union practices after organising with Turkish Textiles Union, TEXIF, including dismissals and prolonged legal delays aimed at weakening workers' resolve. From the beginning, the company has insisted on not recognising the union. Importantly, a local court had confirmed that TEXIF had secured the legally required majority to become the bargaining partner at Digel Textiles. Digel management has ignored the court ruling and pursued further legal action. As TEXIF was planning wider international action to generate solidarity with the workers, Digel management began negotiations in which they indicated they would not file an appeal and instead seek dialogue, only to reverse its position 1 week later. In response, Digel workers will now travel to Germany to hold protests and public actions in front of Digel's headquarters. From Turkey, let's head over to South Korea, and we're talking domestic workers, and in particular, a rather exploitative domestic worker pilot scheme. Domestic workers' unions and advocates for migrant workers in Seoul have brought attention to the exploitative nature of a domestic work program that recently came to an end in the capital after an 18-month pilot. The program brought Filipino caregivers to Korea to work in the homes of families in Seoul. Even though the workers were ostensibly responsible for childcare rather than housework, they were frequently expected to handle all domestic tasks in their employer's house. According to a survey by the Seoul Foundation of Women and Family, Filipino caregivers were also expected to teach English, clean floor mats, clean appliances, and sometimes clean in potentially dangerous areas, such as external windows. The survey also found that the Filipino workers' actual take-home pay, after various deductions, was around $810 a month, nearly half of the minimum wage. Domestic work and childcare are classified as distinct services in South Korea, with the caregiver program largely ignored. The city government pulled the plug on the pilot in December after just 18 months due to ongoing criticism. Last update now, heading over to Palestine, where the Palestinian Union Confederation has appealed to the UN for wages. The Palestinian General Federation of Trade Unions, with the support of international labour unions, is suing Israel for compensation on behalf of West Bank workers who lost their jobs in Israel since October 2023. The petition to the International Labour Organization focuses on the right to wages and protection of workers' social rights in accordance with binding international conventions and agreements. This week, the PGFTU-affiliated Palestinian Workers' Union stated that the situation of these workers is dire since the Palestinian Authority is unable to provide them with unemployment support as it is struggling to pay its own salaries. The total wages these workers are estimated to be owed is around $440 million per month, exceeding the combined wages of both government and private sector employees in the West Bank. Therefore, this loss of wages has had a flow-on effect across local Palestinian economies in the West Bank. The PGFTU is demanding compensation from Israel, amounting to approximately $3 million for 225,000 Palestinian workers who've lost their jobs since 2023. Heading on now to our interview, you're of course listening to Asia Pacific Currents. We have an interview between Giselle Hanna and Bella Pakragi, a socialist activist based in Melbourne, Australia, about the ongoing civil unrest and protest movement in Iran at the moment.
For people who don't know, the Iranian regime that we sort of have today was born out of a period of sort of social rebellion and revolt in the 1979 revolution. Sometimes people sort of see the revolution sort of according to like mainstream history as one where, you know, sort of religious leaders stood up and overthrew the US-backed dictator, the Shah, and then built sort of a new system. But the story is a bit more complicated than that. There was a, you know, massive popular uprising of workers, of students, of the poor, of all oppressed people in the late sort of 1970s that culminated in the revolutionary overthrow of the sort of Pahlavi monarchy. And then there was a power sort of struggle that ensued over the next year or so, so from sort of the beginning of 1979 to the end, between essentially workers, students, and the poor, the masses in society, and then the sort of emerging ruling class headed by the Ayatollah Khomeini. And, you know, unfortunately, did culminate in the sort of popular sort of organs of the revolutions and the demands, you know, for liberation being sort of crushed and consumed by the aspirations of a clerical sort of ruling class who wanted to build a capitalist theocracy, really, to expand their power regionally. So that's sort of what we have today. That's maybe a bit of sort of background context. And I think what we have to see about sort of Iranian politics in terms of like the ruling class and the relationship between the different institutions of the sort of state is one that is very factionalised, which people might not know. So you have the supreme leader, that is a lifetime post, that is, you know, a person who has ultimate say over all policies of the Islamic Republic. But then there's an entire system of clericals that have capitalist control. There's bodies like the Assembly of Experts that are made up of senior like clerical figures. They're elected every 8 years. Then there's the Guardian Council, which is half appointed by the Supreme Leader and half by the Judiciary Chief, who can veto laws passed by Parliament and also disqualify election candidates. So that has been sort of a point of contention over the last few decades, where more reformist, sort of quote-unquote, bit different to the reformism we have here, but, more reformist sort of candidates have been disqualified in favour of more hardline candidates. And that's not even to get to the sort of elite wing of the military, so the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, who form a big power block inside Iran. They control a lot of capital, particularly oil capital and heavy sort of industry, and they influence a lot of politics. And then you have the sort of parliament that is also really factionalised and has sort of been mired by political debate over the past four decades that has pretty much centred on what is the way forward for the perpetual crisis of the Islamic Republic. They've faced economic crisis, political crisis, all whilst attempting to become a sort of regional imperialist power. So that's where you have different sort of factions within the political sort of wings of the ruling class battling it out to try and navigate the way forward. It is a capitalist theocracy, but unlike sort of total dictatorship, say, for example, like in North Korea, partly because of the depth of the 1979 revolution, the sort of clerical regime has had to actually allow a degree of sort of public participation in the election of prime ministers. Now, it's a very controlled sort of participation. It's not, you know, just total freedom of, you know, elections, but that is a particular sort of character, I think, of the Islamic sort of republic that is different from total dictatorships.
Iran's experienced repeated waves of unrest over the past decade, from economic protest to the Woman Life Freedom Uprising. What are the underlying social and economic pressures driving these explosions of resistance, and how do they connect to Iran's position in the global economy?
Yeah, so the latest sort of uprising that we've seen in Iran is just like one of many that has sort of rocked Iran over the past sort of decades. So, you know, in 2017, workers went on strike across the country to demand bread, jobs and freedom. They, you know, burned down police stations and attacked banks. The sugarcane workers in Khuzestan, they established workers' councils, actually, to fight for control over production. And that's sort of since 2017, since that general strike, there has been a wave of sort of like, workers' strikes, of student movements, of uprisings of national minorities, of women, and all of the oppressed against both the sort of political, inadequacies of the regime, but also just the deep, deep economic sort of crisis that I think has ran through really the last four decades of the Islamic Republic. So it has little popular support. It maintains its rule through, you know, Shia force mainly, backed by at least like 16 intelligence agencies and one of the largest civilian militia organizations in the world. But then also the Iranian economy has sort of suffered over, you know, decades and decades of sort of economic crisis. Partly it's been imposed by, you know, US and sort of Western sanctions, but also just like runaway inflation and a collapsing sort of national currency has been sort of made much, much worse by the sort of corruption inside the regime itself. So, you know, despite having the world's second largest gas reserves and, you know, third largest oil reserves, nearly 70% of the population actually lives below the poverty line, which is a pretty terrible sight to see. And the minimum wage for Iranian workers is actually the worst in the region. So it's behind even Afghanistan and Yemen. And like, Iran is quite a modern society, so these sort of figures and stuff are pretty, sort of galling. Meanwhile, the sort of, you know, cabal of criminals that run Iran just totally live it up in luxury with, you know, all of their sort of profits, mainly from, you know, embezzling money in oil industry and other heavy industry.
The 2022 uprising following the killing of Jina Mahsa Amini was one of the most significant challenges to the regime in decades. What made that movement different from previous protests? And what did it reveal about the role of women, youth and the working class in Iran?
Yeah, so the Women Life Freedom Uprising, it was, sparked by the killing of Iran's, of the killing of a young Kurdish woman, Jina Mahsa Amini, by Iran's morality police. And it essentially sparked off a six-month-long struggle against the regime. And I think it was important for a number of reasons and sort of qualitatively different from previous struggles. I think, number one, because of the amount of participation in the actual struggle itself. You know, you had students in sort of the epicenters of, you know, the sort of metropolitan areas that were occupying their universities, that were, you know, demanding that their teachers actually go on strike in solidarity with their demand, you know, for women, life, freedom. But then you also had out in sort of the very, very oppressed regions, particularly the Arab majority provinces and other, you know, provinces with sort of national minorities as a big percentage, you had these just long-running battles on the streets with Iran's, you know, repressive forces. You had, you know, Kurdish women forming their own organizations to, you know, say that, you know, we're not going to wait, you know, for our liberation to be handed down to us. We demand now to be liberated. And then, crucially, you see the entrance of the working class, so the people that actually, you know, make the world run, and that, you know, who I think should run the world. They consciously decided to go on strike in solidarity with, you know, the students particularly who were facing repression on the campuses, but more broadly, the sugarcane workers of the Haftape refinery summed up, I think, what is really at the heart of the sort of working class solidarity with this movement, which was a statement in which they said to have bread and freedom, which was one of their sort of slogans from the 2017 general strike, let us not leave the women of the revolution alone. So I think that that sort of encapsulates the way in which workers, the people that have sort of the economic power to actually stop the gears of, you know, Iranian capitalism, knew that their fight for, you know, liberation from sort of, you know, class exploitation was bound up and inextricable from the political sort of, you know, questions of like women's oppression, which is, you know, a key part of the Islamic Republic. So I think that that meant, number one, that the resistance could continue for actually so long, that it was backed by the power of a section of the working class that are particularly radical, but then also because the sort of like lessons and stuff learnt from previous struggles, I think, were applied into the Women Life Freedom Movement.
And since that uprising, the regime has intensified repression, but dissent clearly hasn't disappeared. What forms is this resistance taking now? Are we seeing workplace struggles, any underground organising, student activism or other forms of opposition that don't always make international headlines?
Yeah, definitely. So since it sort of started well before the sort of current uprising, but for people who might not know, like independent trade unions are illegal in Iran, so are independent student unions. So the regime has about three different sort of state-controlled forms of unions. But since really at least 2004, the process of a sort of small radical section of workers establishing their right to independently organise, you know, and collectively sort of bargain, that fight has been, you know, sort of waged, by bus drivers, by oil workers, by sugarcane workers and other workers in sort of heavy industry, and then teachers and nurses sort of coming in the last few years. And I think that that has been really important because it has meant that throughout every sort of period of resistance, there are these organizations that not only can take the struggle forward into the workplaces, can try and actually educate and agitate amongst layers of society that, you know, we need to, you know, see sort of move into action against the regime, but also because with every period of sort of resistance, there has been a following period of repression. And what is, I think, particularly important to sort of understand and quite amazing, actually, is how these organisations, particularly so the independent student unions and independent trade unions that have been established at sort of great cost, really, to those sort of workers and students involved, that they've been able to carry through lessons that they've learnt in terms of the ways that the regime will try and defeat the struggles, the ways in which they'll try and divide and rule, ordinary people based on, you know, sectarian, religious lines, or trying to whip up and chauvinism, you know, against national minorities. And these organizations have been able to sort of push back on the cynical attempts for the regime to try and, crush the movement and bring it back into its control. And then also outside of periods of massive rupture and revolt, there has just been a proliferation of political organizing and agitating on the shop floor in semi-clandestine and also totally underground organizations, some of which are explicitly socialist, others, you know, have sort of mixed politics, but very much identify with the working class as sort of the social force that, you know, everyone sort of involved in those, struggles in Iran knows, needs to be the sort of force that brings forward radical change. So it's pretty inspiring because these people are literally, you know, risking their lives day in and day out just to, organise, which is, you know, a right that, like, yeah, has obviously been established in Australia. But I think it's important to see that it's a life or death question, actually, in Iran.
Well, speaking of those particular uprisings, tensions between Iran, Israel and the United States continues to escalate. How should we understand the threat of military intervention or regional war, and particularly the intervention of the US and Israel in these uprisings? What is the political impact inside Iran of US sanctions and Israeli aggression? And how do we oppose imperialism without giving political cover to the Iranian regime?
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a really important question for, you know, leftists of all different sort of variety to be really strong on. And I think that we've seen a couple of things. Number one, America and Israel, they always try to exploit popular democratic uprisings in Iran to further their own imperial, you know, domination over the Middle East. So we saw, you know, Trump sort of was very strongly signaling that he was considering a direct attack on Iran during the latest sort of uprising. He warned, you know, Iranian leaders that the U.S. military, quote, was, you know, locked and loaded and ready to go if they continued to kill protesters, which I, you know, we all know that this is a totally cynical, sort of line from a monster who has literally unleashed federal agents to hunt down and lock up migrants and execute, you know, people who defy government sort of terror. So that is, you know, what America and Israel want to do. And, you know, obviously Israel, you know, we've just watched them, you know, commit a mass industrial scale slaughter of the Palestinians for the last, you know, few years. And they, you know, when they say, you know, that we support the Iranian people, we as left just need to obviously not have a bar of it and see it for what it, you know, is, which is, yeah, an attempt for them, you know, to dominate the Middle East. And to be honest, like, we saw a small taste of this in the 10-day war that Israel and America launched on Iran last year, which killed, you know, over 1,000 people, which destroyed a bunch of civilian infrastructure. And I think as socialists, we have to resolutely stand against Western imperialism, against all calls for Western intervention, and see that, you know, the Iranian people's sort of freedom and liberation is, you know, up to the Iranian people themselves. That's one thing. But I think that you know, socialists need to be able to sort of like, you know, walk and chew gum at the same time. So animosity from America and Israel do not mean that socialists should support Iran. It is an authoritarian, you know, capitalist state. It brutalizes its own population. And it's been a key counter-revolutionary force, not just like inside Iran, but actually in the broader region. So if people, you know, remember the 2011 Arab Spring, the revolutions that, you know, swept across the Arab world that brought down dictators, you know, in a matter of weeks, Iran, you know, ordered its sort of revolutionary guard, sort of its elite military to actually, you know, drown these popular uprisings sort of in blood. So most notably in Syria to prop up the Bashar al-Assad dictatorship. And I think some people get confused then of like, well, why does Iran sort of rhetorically like support Palestine? It's partly, I think, one of the ways that it tries to win like popular legitimacy at home and abroad. But it sort of mostly falls, I think, on deaf ears. I think particularly inside Iran, people see that as quite cynical. But while, you know, Iran sort of, you know, might say that they support Palestine, they will never lift a finger to actually help the Palestinians. And like all capitalist states, Iran's only principle is, you know, self-interest. So I think it's a real duty for, you know, leftists to not abandon the people of Iran, not abandon the working class in favour of the reactionary sort of capitalist state, but also not fall into the traps of supporting, you know, Western imperialism and chauvinism.
Well, looking ahead, what are the real possibilities for change in Iran? Is reform from within the system conceivable? Is the regime structurally incapable of reform? And what would it take for a mass movement capable of winning democratic and social transformation to emerge?
Yeah, look, I think that what we've seen over the past even decade of, you know, crisis and class struggle in Iran is that the regime does not have a way out of both the sort of ongoing economic crisis that it faces, but then also, you know, that feeds into a political crisis of, you know, legitimacy for the regime. And with each round of, you know, revolt that happens, the regime sort of more and more has to, you know, look to just totally repressing these struggles. And of course, you know, whilst they can momentarily repress, you know, these struggles, people learn lessons and also their resolve hardens against the regime. So I think that's important to understand, is sort of the crisis at the top of Iranian society has no obvious sort of solution. At the same time, the depths of sort of organizing and resistance from below will weather this current round, you know, of repression. People will learn, you know, lessons from it and will sort of go forward. And we've even seen, you know, heroically protests inside university, you know, campuses and stuff after the sort of mass slaughter of civilians. You know, people are protesting against that, of saying, you know, we demand justice, you know, for those who have been killed. And I think sort of more broadly, we see that, you know, the Iranian sort of working class, it is one of the sort of few working classes, I would argue, in the world with such a depth of radicalism and of sort of militancy, at least amongst sort of a small minority of workers, that actually point the way forward for the struggle against the capitalist theocracy. So that's not going to be an easy struggle in terms of, you know, what I think needs to happen, which is, you know, sort of workers' uprising and revolution, you know, that would overthrow the regime. But I think it has become pretty obvious to, you know, a bunch of sort of radical, you know, workers and students in Iran that that is the only way forward. And so, you know, building the sort of organizations of the working class, of, you know, radical students, of building that sort of class consciousness and of preparing, you know, for the struggles sort of going forward is what they are sort of doing right now. And I think the prospect of sort of revolution in Iran would not just be, you know, sort of significant for the Iranian people, you know, and their fight for liberation, but would actually send ruptures and sort of shockwaves all throughout the Middle East, which is a region that is dominated, by backward, capitalist sort of regimes, but also by Western imperialism. So I think that as socialists sort of seeing the sort of future and the way forward for Iran is through the working class and through working class revolution is actually the sort of best, chance that workers of the, Middle East more broadly can seriously start to challenge imperialism, and capitalism more broadly. So, there's a lot of there's a lot of challenges ahead, obviously, for the sort of movement in Iran, but there's also a lot of glimmers of hope in what they've already been able, to the potential that they, have shown is there.
And that was Bella Behraghi speaking about the situation in Iran. You've been listening to Asia Pacific Currents. That's all we've got for you this week. We'll be back next Saturday with more news and current affairs from the Asia Pacific region.